So it's getting rather late in the week and rather late in the afternoon. So I figured that you're all probably pretty sick of hearing about active processes. So I'll tell you about what is, in some sense, an inactive process. And it has to do with how this little marine bacterium turns, so how it uses its flagellum to make turns. And it's really rather quite novel and interesting, and I hope you find it that way as well. So before I start talking about the science, though, some friends and collaborators that have worked on various bits and pieces of what I'll show today. But the two main players here that have worked on this bacterial turning problem are Roman Stocker and Kwangmin Sun, and this was done in Roman's lab while I was a postdoc there. And Kwangmin is his PhD student and a good friend. So now, whenever I say that I did this or we did that, just replace I and we with Kwangmin, and you'll get the idea. So I don't have to spend too much time talking about any of this, because Jorn Dunkel gave a very nice talk yesterday where he also stole the same pictures from Purcell's paper from the 1970s. But I'll just point out a few additional things to kind of enrich your ideas about microorganisms. So these are all real microorganisms found more or less in the ocean. You'll notice that there are some common threads in the motile ones. So they all use some kind of whip-like flagellum. So whether they're single bacteria, biflagellated algae, this is a paramecium that's covered with carpets of flagella. They all use these whip-like flagella, and they all have to obey the same rules. And the rules that govern these guys are the force interactions between these structures and the equations of fluid dynamics, the Navier-Stokes equation. So since they're so small, they have no inertia, and thus they have to obey what are called the Stokes equations. One of the very interesting properties of these things, among the many interesting properties, is that they're time reversible. So what that means is that it restricts the types of motion that can produce locomotion at these scales. So since I'm an experimentalist, I have to see it happen. So this is what Purcell talked about in his paper. So this is what's called a reciprocal motion that doesn't produce any locomotion. So it's the simplest swimmer that you could think of. It's two links connected by a hinge. And if you ask this thing to swim, it'll do the only thing it knows how to do, which is close this little hinge. And it moves forward, which is great. But then for locomotion, you need to be able to keep moving forward. But this thing can do the only thing it knows how to do, which is reset and get ready for another stroke. The problem is, when you do that, since everything is perfectly reversible, you get back to exactly where you started, and you don't move anywhere. All right. So nature's got a few different ways to get around this. And it's basically based, by and large, on two different flavors of flagellum. The first one is what's called the eukaryotic flagellum. These are the bendy types of flagella. And they're bendy because they have molecular motors that are distributed all the way down the length. And they actually create internal shears that can bend the flagellum. So these sperm cells propagate bending waves toward the back, and then that pushes the cell forward. Cells like Chlamydomonas do this breaststroke type of action. So they reach out their flagella in front of them, and then they pull themselves through the water. And then the other flavor of flagellum that we're going to focus on today is what is more or less a rigid flagellum. This is what's called the prokaryotic or bacterial flagellum. And these things are shaped like corkscrews, and they're completely inactive, except for a motor that's embedded at the base of the cell. And what that motor does is it rotates the flagellum, and the cells essentially drill through the water. Okay, this is a famous movie from Howard Berg's group at Harvard. Okay, so we've done some work on various aspects of some of these different problems over the years. So this is just sort of a smattering of some things that I've worked on. So more recently, we've been looking at comparative studies of the kinematics of sperm flagella from genetically diverse organisms. A few years ago, we did a lot of work on measuring the flow fields that are created by these swimming cells. This is Chlamydomonas, very similar to the work that Jorn presented yesterday. But here what we were doing was measuring the time-dependent flow fields. And one thing that I want to, again, impress upon you is the sort of difference in time scales from the people that are kind of working on crawly things to the people that are working on swimming things. So I heard a time scale or a velocity scale thrown out the other day that was something like microns per day, which blew my mind. So these guys swim at tens or hundreds of microns per second. So most of the measurements that we do have to do with high-speed video, so 500 to 1,000 frames per second. Some other recent work is on coral flows. So these corals are actually covered with cilia, and when these cilia beat, they propel the fluid across the surface of the corals, and they assist in mass transport for energy uptake and so forth. Okay, so what these things really are the building blocks of active suspensions. And we've also done some work on these things, so you can consider the interaction of the flow fields of these individual swimming cells as sort of enhancing the mixing of the bath that they're swimming in. If you get these cells to high enough density, then their flow fields start to affect other swimmers, and this is how you can get emergent dynamics like collective behavior. Another type of interaction is between the swimmer's flow field and an externally imposed flow field. So these are swimming bacterial cells that are in a Poiseuille flow, and you can see that they tend to collect in special regions of these fluid flows. And then finally, we do a lot of work with microfluidics and chemotaxis, so we look at how we can use chemical gradients to direct the motion of, these are sperm cells. We can also do this with bacterial cells. Okay, so these are more or less the swimming problems or the propulsion problems. But this is really only half the story of motility. Okay, the other half has to do with turning. All right, so most of us don't have the luxury of being able to get in our car and drive straight to the supermarket without making any turns. I think that would be a rare case. Usually you have to make at least one turn, right? So do these cells when they're looking for food or mates or nutrients, or even if they're trying to escape from toxins. So Ray Goldstein's group from Cambridge has done a lot of really nice work on Chlamydomonas. And what they've shown is that when these cells swim straight, they coordinate their flagella and they beat them in synchrony and they swim in straight lines. And then when they want to turn, all they do is beat one flagellum a little faster than the other. So this is like rowing a rowboat with one oar and you go around in a circle. So they can make these sharp hairpin turns. You can even make turns if you're a eukaryote and you have one flagellum. So like the sperm cell, you can just bend it more on one side than on the other, and that sends you around in some kind of arc. Okay, so those are the eukaryotes with their flexible flagella. there we go, okay. It's also known how some bacteria turn. So these are bacteria like E. coli that have multiple rigid flagella. So when E. coli wants to swim, it spins all of these flagella with the same sense. And these flagella bundle together in what's essentially a superhelix. And they keep spinning, and then the cell swims forward. And then when they need to turn, what they do is they just counter-rotate one or more of these flagella. You'll see one cell come in here. And you see that one flagellum kick out of the bundle. It gives the cell a random turn, and then it continues on its way. So these cells, these bacterial cells, tend to turn randomly. And you might ask, well, what good is random turning? Well, it's not about how you turn, but about when you turn. So if this cell is trying to get from here to wherever the food is, if it swims down this attractant gradient, it can sense the concentration, and it can sense that life is getting worse, so it will turn more often. And that will eventually reorient it toward the direction of the attractant. And once it senses that things are getting better, it doesn't turn as much, so it keeps swimming in that direction. And we know this works. We can observe this in microfluidics or just on a cover slip with an air bubble. And these are some little cells that like oxygen, so you can see that they accumulate. So all of this works. All right. Now the question and the problem comes when we start to consider bacteria that just have one flagellum. And remember, these are essentially rigid, okay? And these are very important cells. If you're a bacterium that lives in the ocean and you swim, 95% chance is that you only have one flagellum, okay? And these are a lot of the cells that are involved in biogeochemical cycling and the health of our oceans and planets. So they're very important little guys. They also spread disease, things like Vibrio cholera. These are all in the same category. The guy that we're looking at is Vibrio aeruginolyticus. And what's interesting about these cells is really the history of them. So as far as we've known about these cells, biologists have told us that these cells just spin their flagellum and they swim forward. And then when they counter-rotate it, they retrace their steps and swim backward. And the only way you deviate from that is through rotational Brownian motion. But this is completely bogus and it's totally not the case. And this was just figured out by a group from the physics department at the University of Pittsburgh, Xiaolun Wu's group. And what they showed is that these cells actually turn a lot, and they turn in a very interesting way, and they're even better chemotaxers than cells with multiple flagella. Right? So they're really amazing. So let me walk you through what this little guy is doing. So this is the data from Wu's really fantastic PNAS paper from 3 years ago now. So if you start, let's say, here, and you follow this green trajectory, the cell is swimming forward. So that means that the body's first, tail's in the back, and then it reverses its flagellum, the rotation sense, and it retraces its steps. And then the interesting bit is when it switches from backward motility to forward motility, and it makes this 90-degree turn. Okay, that's the interesting thing. And these are what are called flicks, for reasons that will be kind of obvious eventually. And the question becomes, how can these cells, with no known motor apparatus to move their flagellum off axis, make these types of turns? So this is the tantalizing video that was published with this paper in PNAS. And what it shows through conventional microscopy is that the cell is backing up. Wait till it starts again. So it backs up, and then the flagellum appears to bend off axis, and in one or two frames of video, it turns. Okay. So the question that we had when we saw this was, well, how does this thing do this? Because we know just about everything about the anatomy and the genetics of these things, and there's nothing in there that says that they should be able to do this. So that's where we sort of picked up this story. And the first thing that we did was to image these things at a much, much higher frame rate. Now, we can't see the flagellum in this case, but we know that the flagellum's on this side because it's about to execute one of these 90-degree turns. So this is at about 1,000 frames per second. The backward swimming is color-coded in green, that's this bit, and then the forward swimming is color-coded in red, and then the turn is in blue. Okay, so watch what this guy does. So it backs up, and then before it turns, it swims forward for about 10 or 20 milliseconds, right? And then it initiates this turn. So I'll let that play through one more time. It's a long video. Okay, it's backing up. It swims forward, and then it turns. Okay, so this is the piece that we're interested in. So it's actually swimming forward before it starts to turn. But this was a little dissatisfying because we couldn't see the flagellum. So the next thing that we did was to use a dark field microscopy technique to see this little blob is the flagellum. And here we've marked it a little more clearly. It's the same exact video other than this purple marking. And what I want you to notice is where the flagellum bends when it does this maneuver. So it bends right at the base. I'll let that play again one more time. Okay, so now we have these two clues. The cell's swimming forward, and the flagellum's bending at its base. Well, what does the forward swimming imply in terms of the forces? Well, we know that these things are little dipoles because the flagellum produces thrust, and when the cell backs up, the thrust is pulling the cell, the drag resists, so this dipole makes the cell in tension, and then when the cell switches to forward swimming, the sign of the dipole changes, and now the cell is in compression. So we're thinking now about long, slender elements like these flagella in compression, right? So we think about buckling. But this isn't the whole story of the anatomy. There's also another little tiny piece that connects the flagellum to the body. It actually connects the flagellum to the motor. So the cell membrane is right about here, and this little blob is the motor, and then this thing is the hook. And the hook is about the same diameter as the flagellum. It's about 20 nanometers, but it's only about 100 nanometers long. But there are these two elements that we need to consider. There's been some work on both of these elements, one by Holger, who considered buckling of flagella, and another one by Amon Gaffney's group, who talked about buckling of this little hook piece. But what we want to know is, in this realistic, not realistic, but in this real situation, this lab situation, what are the forces, the compressive forces on the cell, and what are the critical buckling loads of these two elements? So which one of these is the culprit, if either, for this buckling instability that we're hypothesizing? So we can estimate the compressive forces, which are just some shape factor times the viscosity times the velocity of the cell. So remember, at low Reynolds number, the force is linear with the velocity. That's important. And then we can also estimate the critical buckling loads. So there's, again, another shape factor if you're a helix or a straight pipe. And then the critical load is proportional to EI, which is what we call the stiffness. So this is the Young's modulus times the area moment of inertia of this beam divided by the length of the beam squared. Right? So right away, this doesn't sound very good for the hook, because this is about an order of magnitude longer. So the critical load should be something like two orders of magnitude lower. Right? So it should buckle first. But if you look in the literature, what you find is that the EI is actually something like a factor of 10,000 difference. So you actually have to do the calculation to figure out which one's going to buckle. And it turns out to be pretty obvious in the end. So the critical buckling load of the flagellum is something like 50 piconewtons. The hydrodynamic load is only around 1 piconewton, so there's no chance, in this situation at least, that it's the flagellum for this particular guy. But this hydrodynamic load is actually pretty comparable to the critical load for this hook, because it's so soft, right? So this means that we have the chance for this thing to be buckling. The hard question here is, how do we show this, right? So I'm a mechanical engineer, so is Kwang Min. Roman's a civil engineer, so we know how to make things buckle on large scales, but we never really think about it at small scales. So we had a couple of different ideas having to do with optical traps or magnetic traps or AFMs, but what we settled on was something we think slightly more elegant and much less invasive. So what we know is that these cells are already turning or flicking, okay? And we are hypothesizing that this has to do with them buckling. So what we need to do is make them not buckle and find out when that happens. So if we can lower the hydrodynamic load below the critical buckling load, then these flicks should go away. And there's a nice way to lower the hydrodynamic load on these cells. Because the load is directly proportional to swimming speed, all we have to do is slow the cells down. And if we slow the cells down, we can reduce this load below the buckling load. These flicking behaviors should go away. Okay. Now, since these are marine bacteria, these little rotary motors that they have are run on sodium ions. So if you just take some sodium out of the medium and replace it with magnesium, the cells are perfectly happy, and all you do is slow down their motor. There are less ions available to run through the system, to run through the rotor and stator. So this is what these cells look like at a five-fold reduction in the sodium concentration. They swim at about 40 or so microns per second compared to about 50. They're perfectly happy. They do these walks just as they did before, and no problems. Now, something really dramatic happens when we drop this sodium concentration down to about 3 millimolar. Right, so they just swim back and forth now without making these turns. So this is looking pretty good for our argument. If everyone would believe these two videos, we can call that the end of the story. But since we're physicists and engineers, we have to quantify these things and make sure that they're statistically robust. So the way that we do that is every time these cells reorient, whether they make a reversal like this or a flick maneuver like this, we identify those maneuvers and we measure the angle that they make. So we measure this angle. And then we do this for cells at a bunch of different sodium concentrations so that we cover a wide range of swimming speeds. And then what we do is we pool all of this data together because at one sodium concentration, the distribution in swimming speeds could be quite broad. So we pool all the data together, and then we rebin it according to these color bars at the top, so you see these shaded areas. And then what we can do is start to analyze the statistics of these turning angle distributions as a function of swimming speed. So this is what they look like. This is at normal swimming speeds or high swimming speeds. That's the purple line. So it's bimodal. You see that there's one peak centered around 180 degrees, and there's one peak centered around 90 degrees. And this was shown in the original work by Wu as well, and this is perfectly consistent with what they showed. And what we can do from this is you can identify some angle at which these cells are, you're identifying flicks versus reversals. There's some ambiguity because they could flick and end up swimming at this angle too, but that's a very small probability. So anyway, what you can then realize is that this lobe of the distribution starts to decrease as you increase the swimming speed. So what we do is we then measure the area under this curve. We call that the probability of flicking or buckling, whichever you like to think of it as. And then we plot that as a function of swimming speed. So this is what it looks like. And we were really thrilled when we saw this because it looks something like a phase transition. So you start out at high swimming speeds for these cells, and they have a high probability, about 80% of buckling or of flicking. And then as you decrease the swimming speed below the mean, once you get to about 35 microns per second, that's about the half height of this transition. Once you get down to the low end, below about 25 microns per second, we basically, to within our error, we can't tell if they're flicking or not. Okay. You can alternatively think of this in your mind as the probability of buckling as a function of force, right? Because the velocity and the force are linear with one another. All right, so we were really thrilled about this. We were kind of patting ourselves on the back, and then we realized that there's one major problem with this whole argument. And I'm not ashamed to admit it in front of everyone here. And that is that these cells swim forward all the time on these long runs without buckling their hook. So the question is, how in the world can they do this? And we had to go back to the literature to get a few clues. So one clue came from this work by Block and Berg from 1991. What they did was they took E. coli, and they fixed the flagella to a surface, and then they used an optical tweezer to spin the cell. And what they saw was that the hook can twist about half of a turn before it stiffens. So this thing stiffens and twists. And then there was another study a few years later by Samite, and they did this beautiful cryo-electron microscopy of the hook of, I believe it was Salmonella. And what they showed is that it has these helical protofilaments that wrap around once the protein is tiled together. And their explanation of what Berg saw was that as you twist this thing, these protofilaments bump into one another sterically, and they prevent it from twisting anymore. And that's where the stiffening comes from. But they also hypothesized that this twisting should also increase the bending stiffness, right? So this was what caught our eye. So our idea at this point, our hypothesis, is that when these cells are swimming steadily forward, the torque generated by the motor twists this hook and stiffens it. So it prevents the hook from buckling. And then when the cell reverses direction, the motor has to change direction. So that unwinds the hook, makes it floppy, and allows it to buckle, right? So this is the hypothesis. So now we have to test the hypothesis and see if it works. So the way that we have to do this is we have to measure the hook stiffness, this little 100 nanometer long, 20 nanometer diameter beam. When it's relaxed, that's when it's untwisted, and when it's twisted, when the cell is fully swimming, okay? So this is how we do it. To measure the relaxed hook when it's untwisted, we just fix some cells to a glass surface, and then we can just watch their flagella kind of wag around in the breeze due to Brownian motion, and you can track that angle. If you model the hook, which has some EI and some length, as a little torsional linear spring, you can then just measure the angles that this flagellum makes with the body, compute some statistics on that distribution and relate it to the EI. And the important thing here is that the EI is something like 10 to the minus 26 newton meter squared. Okay, so 10 to the minus 26 is what you have to remember for one whole slide. The next thing that we had to do was measure the stiffened hook. So this is a cell that's swimming steadily forward, and then it's going to reverse direction and swim backward. Right, so you notice something pretty obvious here, and that is that the cell seems to wobble, right, when it's going forward, and then that wobble is kind of reduced when it's swimming backward. So it's not actually a wobble like this, as it is seen in this plane, but rather what we think is happening is that the thrust and the drag put this thing in compression, and it gives a little kink to the hook. So what you're seeing is actually the precession of this kinked flagellar body complex spinning around. So you're seeing the projection of that thing. So all we have to do to compute the forces here is measure the amplitude of that wobble angle, and then relate that to the bending stiffness of the hook. So we can get the drag force because we know the shape of the cell and we know the velocity that it's traveling in. And once we crunch all the numbers, and we do this for a statistical number of cells, we find that this is 10 to the minus 25 newton meters squared. Right? So what we see, this all seems consistent, is that the hook stiffens by a factor of about 10, which could prevent it from buckling. Okay? All right, so now for full disclosure, if anyone knows anything about Euler buckling, which I didn't before this, so in Euler buckling, it's the simplest way that you can really analyze buckling of beams. Elements can buckle in compression, or they can buckle in torsion, or they can buckle in combined compressional torsional loading. And that's really the situation that we have. So what we did was so the stability condition, when you have a combined loading, I should say first, is that the force on this beam, the axial force, normalized by the critical force, which is given here, plus the square of the torque that's applied, divided by the critical torque, has to be less than or equal to 1. Okay, so if it's greater than 1, it's unstable and buckling. If it's less than 1, it's stable and it's not buckling. Right? So what we did to see where this thing is on the stability diagram is we measured cells that were swimming steadily forward and steadily backward. So we measure the velocity. The velocity gives us the forces and torques. And then we can compute the critical load by the EI that we've already measured. And for these guys, since they're steadily swimming, we apply the stiffened EI. And the stiffened EI is rather large, so that goes in the denominator. That makes this normalized force and normalized torque very small. So it drives these numbers toward the origin. For the other case, when the cell's about to turn, we can also measure the velocity during that short forward swimming period. When we apply the relaxed EI to that case, since the EI is smaller, that makes the normalized force and the normalized torque larger. So it drives it out toward this marginal stability region. So it actually kicks it over into the unstable region where it can buckle. Okay, so that's the idea. And all of this is consistent. There are, of course, big error bars on some of these things, but we're definitely in the order of magnitude. That's all consistent. The last thing that I'll say before I finish is that I don't want you to come away from this thinking that this is some parlor trick that some unique bacterium from some corner of the world does, but rather it's the opposite. We think that this is rather ubiquitous. And the way that we've tried to show this is by measuring these same statistics and buckling parameters for other cultured cells that are monotrichous. We did one more thing, and this is perhaps enabled by being at MIT, so we have all of these graduate students that just can't wait to get out of MIT and go to nice places like Santa Barbara. So Quang Min volunteered to go to Revere Beach in Massachusetts, which is nothing like what we have outside the window. And he brought a bottle or two or five of seawater back to the lab. If you look around for some big, juicy, dead thing like this copepod, what you find is that there are lots of little bacteria that are feeding off of it. And if you track all of these little cells, you'll see that they do this very typical run, reverse, and flick maneuver that we and Wu's group from Pittsburgh have characterized. And in fact, if you do some statistics, what you find is that upwards of 60 to 70% of these cells do this behavior. And that's why we think that it's much more ubiquitous. Now, we don't know what these cells are. They could all be Vibrios, but the chances of that are kind of small. Okay, so I'll just leave it there and take any questions that anyone has. That's pretty fast.
Thank you. So there are questions here.
Thanks, very nice talk. I was wondering, the bacteria actually spin as they swim, and this leads me to two questions. One is, how do you actually know the torque? And the second is, when you plot your oscillating thing, how do you know there's not just a projection effect?
The first part, from the known average anatomy of these cells, you know the, so you have to kind of take a leap of faith on what exactly the flagellum looks like, because you can't see it always, and you can't resolve the, you know, the helicity and so forth. But we can measure the shape of the cell, right? So if we know how fast it's moving, and we assume some parameters for the shape of the helical tail, that's enough information to back out what the rotation speed of the body is. All right, so that's all. And what was your second question? Could you remind me?
The second is, therefore you know the torque on the hook.
Yeah.
But when you then you showed us kind of statistics on the angle that the hook makes with the cell body, or the flagellum makes with the cell body, that one.
This one?
Yes.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
How do we know that that oscillation is not just the projection of the rotation of the cell body?
It's a projection of the rotation of the cell body. So what I'm saying is that it is a projection of the angle that's formed between these two elements. Is
that kind of the angle is fixed? And
yeah. So that's exactly right. So I'm saying that this angle is fixed, and this thing is kind of rotating around this axis. And
yeah,
that's why you see that projection. So I think you're seeing the projection of that thing spinning.
Perfect.
That, yeah.
Okay. Further questions? Yes. Yeah.
Maybe. In your last slide, you mentioned robotics. So I was wondering if there is robots working like this, or if you can think of some.
So I know nothing about robotics, but when we showed this to some roboticists, their eyes lit up. Because this is this maneuver is apparently something well sought after in robotics. It's what's called underactuated dynamics, and that's where you have one actuator that gets you multiple degrees of freedom, right? So there are some robotics groups now at MIT that we've been chatting with that are thinking about building little things that maybe have some flexible element between a propeller and a head, and to get that thing to buckle, you could just give it a little kick in the swimming speed and make it buckle and then turn. So yeah, this is something that roboticists really want.
I just want to understand this kind of nice phase transition like curve you showed as a function of swimming speed, I guess. And you had like several salt concentrations, but then you had something like all salt.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand this, you could construct this curve even without changing salt by just separating out cells that swim at different speeds. Is that really what this is telling
us? That's exactly what this is. So the colored markers are, if you bin all the salt concentrations together, it follows this blue curve. And then if you treat each salt concentration separately, so if you just take, let's say this highest salt concentration, and you break it up into bins based on swimming speed, then you get these gray markers.
Okay.
Right. So what we're showing here is that they both follow the same curve, so changing the salt concentration doesn't have an effect on their motility.
So I guess does that mean that if I did take something in the standard salt concentration and just separate out swimming speeds into different bins, they'd also follow this curve?
Yeah, that's precisely what we're showing. So
if you
look at this circular marker. Right, that's all 513 millimolars.
Oh, there are several circles.
So here's one, right?
Yeah.
So that's at one swimming speed. This is at another swimming speed.
Oh,
another
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
Right, so they all follow the same curve. So that's why we're showing it's kind of consistent.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe you said this and I missed this. So if you look at the buckling criteria, there is the forward motion and you could have flicks, but there's also the backward motion and you could have flicks.
Yes, yes.
So what breaks that symmetry?
So the fact that you're when it's swimming backwards, it's in tension, so that tends to suppress the torsional buckling when it's swimming backwards. Is that what your question was? Yeah.
So you found this, it's back here. So you found this sort of weak spot in the flagellum, and you also showed that there's some electron microscopy structure to it.
Yeah.
So I wonder, is there some regulation of this? I mean, is the cell using this to react to the environment?
You know, where is it? Oh, did I pass it? Yeah, I think I passed it. We'll get there eventually. Here we go. And there, okay.
Yep.
All right, so how do you mean that it's reacting to the environment? Do you mean dynamically, or do you mean that this is kind of built to the environment?
Maybe something can bind here, and I mean, that not only the physics, but maybe also the local chemistry might change this, the buckling?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. So there's some folks that have worked on the hook stiffness of E. coli. And to change hook stiffness for E. coli, they have mutants where they can just adsorb some small molecules to this thing. And it has the effect of sort of filling in these gaps and increasing the stiffness. So there's certainly the potential for that, but I really don't know anything about real life chemistry in the ocean for these guys. I don't know.
Further questions? That's not the case. So let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.